We decided we were gonna go for it. We were gonna do what everybody said was crazy, and we were gonna try to get to Japan. And so while we were traveling, we didn't have jobs besides taking care of people's pets and homes. So Evan spent tons of time researching the startup business visa, ideal climates for honeybees, farming, everything we wanted to find our target in Japan, which it's like, how do you pick one place? But
I was going to
they
ask, how do you pick between Japan and Mexico? Those are two very different environments, aren't they? Hi there, folks, and welcome or welcome back to Nippon Trading International's Japan Real Estate Podcast. I'm your host, Ziv Nakajima again, and this podcast is brought to you, among others, by Emil Gorgis of realestate.jp. He's a Tokyo real estate agent who specializes in serving international or mixed nationality families who are looking for the perfect family home. So Emil's an Australian. He's been living here in Japan for over two decades now. And for about half of that time, he's been buying, selling, and managing real estate properties in Tokyo on behalf of his own family and a great many happy clients. And he also acts as a mortgage broker on behalf of his clients. So he's got dedicated loan officers in many of the Japanese mega banks. And if you're a regular listener of the podcast, you probably already know him from our JREP, the Japan Real Estate Experts panel sessions, which means that you're already aware of the fact that the man is an absolute fountain of wisdom on all things related to real estate in Japan, and in particular to family homes, the greater Tokyo metropolitan area, and mortgages. And most importantly, he's incredibly generous with his time and advice, which he's more than happy to provide at no cost or commitment to anyone asking. So if you've been thinking about buying your home in Tokyo, but you've been sitting on the fence for a while, or you just want to have a chat in English with a real expert, drop him a line on sales@realestate.jp. Hit him up today and start exploring your options. All right, so for today's episode, I've been waiting for this one. I think you'll love it. This is an interview with Danny and Evan Benton, founders and operators of the Benton Homestead, who have built and are running one of Japan's most popular foreigner-managed short-term stay hospitality properties on Omishima Island. I'll keep this introduction brief so that you can hear their origin story directly from the horse's mouth, so to speak, and all about how they got from pet sitting and massage therapy to farming, hospitality, and living off the land. But we do cover a lot of the topics that many of our listeners are regularly interested in, which are hospitality or minpaku properties, short-term stay businesses, the startup and business manager visa, choosing the right location for your guest house, working with immigration lawyers and Japanese property professionals, as well as with local contractors and tradesfolks, how to supplement your income stream aside from the basic guest fees, advertising, marketing, driving business, guest profiles, both Japanese and foreigners, and different types of bookings, fees and charges, property selection, and what it actually means to buy one of the infamous super cheap or semi-free rural Japanese akiyas or vacant homes. We talk DIY renovations and how to teach yourself to do those, how long it actually takes to set up such a business, how to liaise with the local community, and also some not directly related stuff like what it's actually like living long-term in the Naka, the Japanese countryside. Bees, pickles, chickens, you name it. So without further ado, I give to you the fabulous Evan and Danny Benton of Benton Homestead. Enjoy the conversation, and I'll see you again on the other side. All right, so Danny and Evan Benton of the Benton Homestead, in case anyone's been living under a rock, highly recommend to go to YouTube and check them out. They not only have been living, successfully applied for and gotten a business management visa in Japan and have been living here for quite some time, but they are also, I think at least, the poster child for all of those people that constantly contact us with this ever-recurring dream of buying and renovating and Airbnb-ing in Akiya somewhere in the Japanese countryside, and then actually leveraging that to get a business management visa. Which is a really, really, macro level kind of title to a procedure that actually has quite a few moving pieces in it, which with your permission, I'll get you to dive into straight away. So could you give us like, you know, the origin comic story number one kind of thing?
Sure. So we are Evan and Danny Benton, and we grew up, we're both from America. So we grew up in rural, small town Oregon. We met in high school and then we started dating not until we were 30. So we connected there. And at that time, we were both living in Portland, Oregon. I was a professional photographer. I studied graphic design in college.
Oh, wait, how old are you now? You don't look that much older than 30.
I am almost 41 and he's 41.
Okay, cool.
So I studied graphic design and did photography, and Evan studied music performance and Japanese. And he was at that time for many years had been a massage therapist. And shortly after we started dating, we decided to pack up and leave Portland for New Orleans, Louisiana. And we spent 5 years there. Evan was really the spearhead for teaching ourselves how to farm and raise chickens and honeybees. And so our time in Louisiana was really spent learning all of that, which we had no background in before. Then fast forward a little bit, 2021, we decided we wanted to take basically what we had, which was just like an urban farm, and we had an Airbnb in our duplex there. And we wanted to take that and expand upon it in either Mexico or Japan. So at that time, Japan's borders were closed, and we spent 14 months as full-time traveling house and pet sitters throughout Mexico. So we got to see a ton of Mexico, and it was great. And we do love Mexico, but we decided we were gonna go for it. We were gonna do what everybody said was crazy, and we were gonna try to get to Japan. And so while we were traveling, we didn't have jobs besides taking care of people's pets and homes. So Evan spent tons of time researching the startup business visa, ideal climates for honeybees, farming, everything we wanted to find our target in Japan, which it's like, how do you pick one place? But
I was going to
they
ask, how do you pick between Japan and Mexico? Those are two very different environments, aren't they?
so different, and we really do love them both. What it really came down to was property prices. There are lots of little things. There's tons of reasons that we're in Japan and we love Japan. But property prices here for the farming, we need a lot of land, and we wouldn't on our budget have been able to afford that in Mexico. The daily cost of living there is significantly cheaper, but property prices are still fairly close to US prices.
Okay, that's very interesting. For some reason in my mind, Mexico was like the cheaper end of the scale compared to Japan, but apparently not. Okay, so then you and how did the whole eco farming honeybees thing come about?
You want to talk about that?
So as a massage therapist, I had really no intention of getting into any sort of like alternative or controversial types of, subjects. But basically what ended up happening is people would come to me and say, mainstream medicine can't help me with whatever I've got going on. And so what can you do? And so I ended up spending 12 years just studying, strange medical conditions and strange medical treatments, and I ended up learning all kinds of different stuff about things that are sort of being more popularized these days, just but I really got concerned about like the urban living environment, and like EMF and things like that. And I got really concerned with the way that food was grown, and beyond just like massage, which is manual therapy manipulation, I found that nutrition was one of the biggest things you could do to help someone. So I started trying to help myself with just that was the big impetus, was growing healthy food to begin with, because there's so many problems with our food supply. And yeah, that's where it all started, really. And then we got into watching YouTube videos with the homesteading thing and the self-sufficiency type of a lifestyle, and that's really what we were hoping to find.
In New Orleans, we were growing gosh, I don't know what percentage. We were growing a ton of our own vegetables. So we were growing most of the vegetables that we consumed ourselves, plus then
This
all
is
of our own
because, sorry
eggs.
for interjecting, this is because if you want to eat healthy and you're not growing it yourself, it's very expensive, isn't it?
Yes, yeah, for sure. And you need to know your farmer, and so if you're not able to grow it yourselves, it's a matter of making those connections with your local farmer and just how the food is grown, that sort of thing. So that's what we really sort of focused on in New Orleans while we were learning.
Okay, and then where did the idea of turning it into a business come from?
Well, we'd always made, I mean, the joke is that everyone from Portland is into pickling vegetables, and we are from Portland and we made pickles. So, yes, we are that stereotype. But so we started a small pickling company and making like jardiniera and pickled jalapenos and, of course, cucumber pickles and hot sauce. And so that's sort of in addition to growing our own food, Evan is really into making foods and fermenting foods and that
As we're
sort
speaking, I'm just strolling over to your shop to do some shopping, actually. Sorry, go ahead.
of Yeah. So it sort of goes hand in hand, because if you're growing your own food, you also have to preserve it and or ferment it or make things too. So do you have anything to add to that?
Well, just the whole lifestyle of centering your life around food. And in terms of a business, I think just, that was always one of the foremost thoughts in my mind was just finding a way to finance this kind of lifestyle, really.
Okay, so then you decided on Japan mainly due to property prices. I guess the infrastructures here are a bit more convenient too, or am I wrong about that?
For sure. Yeah, we wanted, so property prices was a big draw, but of course, Evan minored in Japanese, and so it would be a good use of his ability to be able to speak the language living in Japan. Also, we were really looking for rural life, but not remote. There's so many amazing houses and villages in Japan that are just super remote and it takes hours to get there. But we want the middle ground, sort of. So the island that we chose, where we've got a constant flow of tourists, which was one of the requirements that we had, and we're 30 minutes in either direction from a couple different big cities. So, we've got rural countryside life. We've got, our neighbors. We're essentially living in a small village. So we see all of our neighbors pretty much every day, and have that sort of village community. But we don't have trains like the rest of Japan has because we're on an island, but we are within, 30 minutes to an hour of pretty much anything we need.
That's via ferry if you want to get off the island, or
No, it's a series of bridges. So
okay.
the ferry is one option. The ferry can take you quite a few places up near Hiroshima from where we are. There's also a ferry straight across the sea to Osaka. But for us, no, it's a 30-minute drive on the bridges, and that's actually what draws the tourists to our area. So the Shimanami Kaido, if you're not familiar, is it's a series of seven suspension bridges.
Yep.
It takes you from Hiroshima Prefecture to Ehime Prefecture, and it's one of only three bridges that connect Shikoku to the other islands.
Right.
So it's sort of a major thoroughfare, and interestingly, bicyclists from all over the world are familiar with these bridges. It's so popular to come here and ride your bikes across the suspension bridges.
Right. Okay. So you decided on Japan, you decided on the spot, I guess. Then what were the next steps?
Well, another thing that drove us to this spot specifically was that we knew that we wanted to go for the startup visa prior to the business manager visa. So the startup visa, there might be some changes coming this year according to Japan immigration, but when we got it, it was a 6-month time frame, and it's only offered in certain places. So I think there's about a dozen places throughout Japan that you can get the startup visa. And so we were specifically looking for one of those locations. So that's what brought us here initially, is this was the only place that met our climate requirements, tourism, startup visa, everything we were looking for, sort of this location offered.
And you knew at that point, I think it's okay to disclose that you were working on the visa with Shimizu-san, who's a good friend of ours and also has helped many of our customers and acquaintances. So did the startup visa idea come from him, or did you already come to him ready, knowing that this is the one you want to go for?
We approached him based on a number of recommendations. He's recommended by so many people. I think we first heard of him through the Cheap Houses Japan, Michael, who runs that page. He introduced him to us, or gave us his information as a recommendation. And then we started seeing that he was recommended by many big groups, including yours. So he's been amazing to work with. Shimizu-san is so great. I think he's given above and beyond effort into our visa applications. I think the first business manager extension application he submitted for us, he said he had like something like 20 supporting documents showing, he attached news articles and pictures of us volunteering at the library, and just made this like whole package to submit to immigration. And I do think that that helped, because both times we've submitted our extensions, we've gotten a response within 7 to 10 days. And he always says, oh, this could take 4 to 12 weeks to get a response. And we always just get a super fast response. And I think that a lot of that is because of the work that he does.
I think also, I was going to dig into that a bit later, but I think also the immigration department always looks at how much money the business has made at the end of that first year. And I think not just in your case, but with a lot of hospitality type properties, bed and breakfast, Airbnb, whatever the case may be, that's very hard to get to a high level of income after the first year, isn't it?
We were really hoping for so we had the 6 month startup, and then we had the first year of business manager. Shimizu-san said that you almost always only get 1 year after to start off. And then we've had one renewal since then, and we got another 1 year visa. And I think that's only because the first year we did spend more than we make, because we were investing in the guest house and all of that. So if we had had a little bit better financial numbers, he said it was very possible that we could have gotten 3 years at that time.
Which is
So,
what you're going for now, right? I just watched your 1 year recap video.
yes. So we have our, I think, we've got most of this year. Our next extension will be filed probably October or November. And at that point, we're really, really hoping for 3 years.
Okay.
We interrupt this broadcast to tell you about Tokyo Family Stays. They're a short-term rentals company in Tokyo, and they offer a home away from home experience, which is just perfect for remote working, quarantining, if that's still a thing, or if you just need somewhere quiet to get away from the world. They offer a variety of options for families, corporate relocations, or even if you're simply transitioning between homes in Tokyo. The properties are super comfortable, tastefully furnished, fully equipped with all amenities, and they accommodate up to 10 people. So, really, the only thing you'll need to bring with you is your toothbrush and maybe a change of clothes. They come with fast, unlimited wireless internet, dedicated workspaces, and fully equipped kitchens, and they're just a delight to stay in. Fantastic alternative to Japanese business hotels, which, if you've ever stayed in one, you probably know they're tiny, they're noisy. Fine for a night or two if you're on your own, but longer term or with a family, you'll probably feel you're in a jail cell very quickly in a Japanese business hotel. So if you want to give yourself a sense of space and freedom by renting a real home with comfortable Western beds, including all the necessities like baby bedding, children's toys, high chairs, etc., you definitely want to reach out to Tokyo Family Stays. They've been at it for over a decade. They're a fully licensed minpaku or short-term stay operator. And as a special bonus for our viewers and listeners, they're also throwing in a breakfast basket upon arrival for for anyone who books and mentions the Japan Real Estate Podcast or NTI. And not only for guests, if you're a property owner, you've got an investment property that you want to tweak for higher profit, or a holiday home that you want to rent out when you're not using it via short-term stays, drop them a line today, see how they can help you maximize your property's income. And again, as a special bonus to our viewers and listeners, they're also offering a free audit of your existing short-term stay listings without any obligation whatsoever. So feel free to reach out to them at tokyofamilystays.com. Well worth a visit. And again, if you're in the market for a family home in or around the Tokyo metropolitan area, Emil's your man. Don't be shy to reach out to him as well at sales@realestate.jp. And now, back to the podcast.
Okay. But you had to, I don't know if you had to, but you chose to, probably wisely so, to supplement your income with other income sources except the guest house itself, right?
Yes. Yeah.
So yes. What else are you doing? I guess it's all under the umbrella of the Benton Homestead, but they're very different types of businesses, right?
Yeah, we had, we did have a plan coming here, but no plan survives contact with the enemy, as they say.
Yeah.
And so we had to basically be flexible and open to, other stuff as it came in. And Shimizu-san wrote our articles of incorporation in such a way that enabled us to do that. And so the main income streams is the guest house, and we think of it as just farming, in general. But in Japan, they think of things a lot more specifically or specialized. And so our main income stream as farmers is from beekeeping, so honey sales.
Okay, so that generates more income than the guest house.
It doesn't yet. It will.
That's the reason that we started with the guest house, is that it was going to be more consistent income right away versus honey. You're working with living creatures and they take a while to get established. So our first year, we only had a spring harvest, but the numbers from that harvest are super promising. We are anticipating by year three, honey sales will be more than the guest house. Right. So
it takes longer
to get there with honey. Yeah.
So the guest house and the honey, and I see a bunch of other stuff on your shop as well, right?
We weren't planning to open a retro shop, but that is now in the plans. That's one thing I really want to get going this year, is because we purchased, our two houses were full of stuff, but it wasn't garbage. We sort of chose our houses carefully, not only based on location, we're just around the corner from each other, but the house that we're living in, which is completely unrenovated, is full of nice antiques and really savable things. And we actually furnished the guest house where we're sitting right now almost entirely with furnishings from one of the two houses. I'm really into recycling and saving things and making the most use of what we have. So we've restored some furniture. The decorations almost exclusively have come from our two houses. And we still, at our house, we still have two rooms that we haven't even opened all the boxes. I don't even know what's in there, but it's like everything, there is garbage, of course, but some things don't stand the test of time. But every time, say, if I open a box, it's 15% garbage, 15% like so-so things, and then just some really nice antiques. And so the plan next year is that the guest house here has a big garage building. So we're working on getting that renovated and turned into a retro shop, sort of omiyage stand, and we'll sell our honey there and that sort of thing.
And then you're going to be asking all of the local residents to bring all of their leftover stuff that no one's using.
No, they already
don't have to ask.
So many opportunities. Okay. So yeah. We'll get into the houses in a minute, because that's probably what most of our listeners would like to learn more about. But first, I wanted to ask you a little bit, just being selfish here. How did you land on your, obviously your marketing is going quite well. You've mentioned that you've had bookings within a few hours from publishing your listing. How have you decided on your current marketing? How are you doing it? I mean, obviously you had a bit of a background in that personally, but how are you marketing and how did you decide on it and how well is it going?
Well, basically, I'm just putting my degree from over a decade ago to use. I marketing, I'm not very skilled at it, I don't think. But that's I'm fumbling my way through it, I guess is the best way. We never intended to have a YouTube channel, but I'm not sure. How do I answer that?
Well,
I
for starters, you felt comfortable putting your face out there, right? I know when I started, I was strictly audio. I wasn't feeling comfortable in front of a camera. And to this day, I'm not comfortable unless I'm talking to people. That's okay. But I can't point a camera at my face and go off. But you seem to be a natural for that.
Well, I, as a photographer, definitely prefer being behind the camera. So being in front of the camera is very new to me. And I took some persuasion to do it, but we started out making just the renovation videos. We started when we bought this first house, which is the guest house, and I was just like, we're here, we're so far away from our friends and everyone that we know. It's like, how do we even explain what's going on and what we're doing every day? And so the idea of the YouTube videos just sort of started as a way to show our friends what we're doing, and then it sort of just started picking up from there. And we're still a very small channel. We still only have a few thousand subscribers, but we've got a lot of people who watch every video and comment on every video, and so we've made a lot of friends that way. But it really, my intention with the videos really was just to sort of document and share what we're doing. I didn't think that people would like them as much as they do.
They definitely, and is that your main source of marketing for the guest house these days, or do bookings come in from other sources?
Well, I have our Airbnb listing, which we used for the entire first year. I just added booking.com and VRBO, which I'm just sort of testing out. I don't really like the back end functionality as well, but I am giving them a chance. And so that first booking that came within 6 hours of our listing going live, that was strictly just because they found it on Airbnb. That had nothing to do with my own marketing. And then, of course, I've got us on Google Maps, and I try and get a lot of our Airbnb reviewers to go also leave their review there. So a lot of people find us that way. And then we just have the social media, Instagram and Facebook, and that's about it. But we are working on connecting with some, what do you call them, local marketing groups.
Okay.
Green tourism, agritourism.
Right. So these are local, do you mean municipal groups or just like general community groups that market these kinds of things?
Basically people who want to start businesses offering organizing tours here on Omishima.
Right.
So there's a couple of cycling groups. There's Cycle Shimanami, I think they're called, that we've worked with a few times. They're based out of Hiroshima, but they focus on promoting cycling the bridges to English-speaking travelers. And then there's a gentleman who contacted us, and he's working on starting a tour group that'll take people, and I think they're planning like an excursion, one on each island or something. V Go visit a farm on each island and see how everyone operates differently. So the next coming years, we hope to do some more marketing with groups like that.
Gotcha. And what's, if I may ask, what's your current average occupancy vacancy rate throughout the last year, let's say?
Well, we were really, I don't know the actual percentage. I know that we had 80 bookings throughout the entire year. And 20 of those came from people who were already familiar with our story. So 25% of the reservations at our guest house were from people who found us by other means and then traveled to our guest house specifically. We live in an area where tourism really slows down in the winter. So December, January, and February, almost no bookings except for the New Year's. So, which is kind of nice because we do a lot of different things, and that gives us an opportunity to use the winter downtime from the guest house to sort of prepare for the next year.
Or to sleep, that's a bonus.
Yeah.
I have heard about sleep.
What's that?
Okay, and then you've mentioned in your video, or the one that I watched just recently, you've mentioned that most of the bookings are singles, and then next is three people, and somewhere in the middle is two people. So you're renting out rooms, I assume, not the entire guest house, correct?
Actually, we're renting out the whole guest house. So it
The
is a
whole guest house. Okay.
private, yep, one group at a time. And we did that intentionally to sort of set ourselves apart from other accommodations that are already here on the island. So there's a couple of hotels, there's ryokans that rent by the room, there's some hostels, and we're one of very few that in on the whole island chain that is a whole private house rental. So I wanted to be able to host one to right now our current cap is six, but by next year we're hoping to have the maximum group size be 10. But so I do it on a sliding scale. So we have a base rate that is reasonably affordable for even one person, and then for more guests, there's just an extra guest fee.
Oh, okay. That was going to be my next question. Gotcha.
Yep. And that's worked out really well. Like, if we had, the base rate, we're happy with that. And then if we get larger bookings, larger groups, then it's just even better.
Okay, so you'd never say to someone, "Hey, you booked for one person, but I get this other group that wants to book it for four," and no.
Yeah. No. No. Yeah.
Awesome. Okay, so now into the topic of the houses themselves. How did you choose them? How did you, which ones did you, which ones fell through and why? When you did purchase them, what kind of work did you have to put into them? Give me all of the juicy stuff.
Okay.
Well, we did not look at very many houses when we got here. And so the house that we're living in, we found that I think in 2021 from the United States, and we just found it through the realtor's website, I think, or maybe from cheaphouses.com, Cheap House of Japan.
Cheap House in
Yeah.
Japan, yeah.
And I just loved it, love at first sight. And it ended up still being on the market
2 years later.
when we bought it last year. But when we finally had our trip finalized and we contacted the realtor on the island, Nomoto-san, and we said, "We're going to be on Omishima in on these dates and we want to see these houses." First of all, we gave him a list of, I don't know, five or six houses, and he said, "I'm just one man. You can I'll take you to see three houses." And so yeah, so we saw, I think he actually only took us to
We saw three.
so yeah,
Yeah.
so but when we said, well, during the process of talking to him, he said, "Oh, by the way, there's a house in that same neighborhood that is also for sale. It's not listed yet, but would you like to see that?" And so the three houses that we saw was we call it the ryokan. That's where we live. It's a former ryokan or inn. And across the street from that is a barber shop that we also looked at, and then this house. And the barber shop and this house were both listed for 1 million yen, and it was no question, because the barber shop was it was a barber shop with a sort of a house
A
above it.
residence. It was going to be perfect because it's right across the street from our house,
Right.
and it would have been a cute little Airbnb plus also a little storefront that was a former barber shop. But when we compared the two houses for the same price, the guest house needed a lot less work and it's a lot bigger. So we decided on not getting the house directly across the street for the guest house, and instead it's just around the corner.
Now, here's some big news for anyone interested in Akiya, the abandoned vacant homes that are abundant all around Japan for very attractive purchase prices. Akiya Mart, our latest sponsor, is a recently founded online search and discovery tool for Japanese real estate. Its user interface will be very familiar to users of Zillow or Redfin. The platform essentially scouts the internet for property listings, translates them into English, and displays prices in US dollars, all in one place and with a dynamic map interface that makes browsing, finding, and shortlisting your favorite properties a piece of cake. Which any of you have been struggling with the dozens, if not hundreds, of Japanese property websites that are available online and their very clunky interface will probably find a real blessing. They've got already over 500,000 listings on the platform, and the database is expanding daily, ranging from abandoned rural homes to luxury urban properties. Akiya Mart makes it easy to find your dream home in Japan, regardless of your budget. Now, while the platform is essentially free for use, here's an exclusive offer for listeners of the podcast. You can use the promo code NTI to receive $5 off Akiya Mart Pro. The subscription will unlock a bunch of very attractive features for you, including unrestricted access to the entire nationwide property database and a whole range of filters, which will help power charge your search for that elusive perfect home and make it even easier. So hop over to akiya-mart.com. That's AKIYA-MART, akiya-mart.com, and kick off your search today. Okay, so 1 million yen houses. I'll first off say that we would not recommend to anyone who's not planning to be as hands-on as you guys are. Because people do have this dream of, I'll buy something as cheaply as I can get, and then I'll just rent it out as is. So that's clearly, please educate people on
Absolutely,
what that
absolutely.
involved to
If
buy a 1
any
million
of your
yen house.
viewers want to see what a 1 million yen house looks like, they can go look at my blog and see the original photos, and that will probably scare them into looking for a higher budget. Yes.
And a lot of people want an inspection, right? Like a proper
Structure
inspection,
inspection. Yeah.
like someone to come through and certify that the house is not going to fall apart. And at a million yen, that's just not going to happen.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, you can pay for it, but it's just going to tell you that the house is in bad shape, right?
Yeah.
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 So what
So
sort of work was actually involved once you got them?
well, neither of them have structural issues. So that's the biggest thing we were looking for. No termites and no structural issues. The guest house also had no roof issues. So it was really just cosmetic. It was a lot of work. It was a lot of cosmetic work, but there was nothing structural to do. So it was, replacing tatami. Evan replaced the subfloor in two rooms. And that's interesting. So we'd only done minimal renovations and built farm structures in the US. And so coming here, we were also just learning as we did this. Even, on our 6-month time constraint of the startup business visa, we were learning as we went. But the way the traditional Japanese houses are constructed, it makes sense. So, you lift up the tatami and the subfloor needs redone, and Evan was able to just, look at it and say, well, okay, I see what the beams are doing, I see where the damage is, and we can fix it. We
Wait,
hopped.
wait, wait. How does a massage therapist know to do all of that, Evan?
YouTube.
Wow. I really admire you now. Okay.
And like Danny's saying, I mean, you can kind of just tell by looking at it, it's pretty simple.
Yeah, it makes sense. Unlike, a Western style house, I would be terrified to do anything like that with our former houses, the way they're built. But here it's really just like everything's out in the open, and it's like a puzzle that's logically you can make sense of it when you look at it. But we did, before he did the subfloor, we made friends with a nice guy named Steve, and his channel is Real Rural Japan, and he makes just videos about his life in Japan, and he reached out to us, and he's just also a real hands-on guy. So I mentioned to him we were doing the subfloor, and he said, "Hey, put me on video chat." put me underneath the floor and let me take a look at it. And so he confirmed everything that Evan thought and sort of gave him the confidence to do it.
Okay, so mainly cosmetic, but you mentioned no roof, no termites. I'm assuming. So how did you know that? So you did do a structural inspection?
Just ourselves, our realtor, and there was a local contractor that we would be working with came out. He's not an inspector, but between the four of us, we just did a visual inspection of everything. We could see there was no water damage, no cracks in the floor, no red flags looking through it, just besides it being very dirty and almost everything needing replaced.
And termites are a big problem in Louisiana, where we lived for 5 years too. So I had a pretty good idea what to look for those.
Did you get access to the to the foundation space to look for stuff there, or was that?
We could lift up some of the tatamis and peek underneath.
Okay.
So, yeah.
Okay. So then, did you DIY everything? Did you get people in to do it? What did you actually do? And plumbing and wiring, what did the interior work include exactly?
Well, we did hire some contractors, and that was actually the most expensive part of the renovation. I think we did, about half the work ourselves, and about half of it we hired. And part of that is because we don't know how to do electrical, and there was also some plumbing things. But also we had a 6 month deadline, and if we'd had a year, we would have done a lot more ourselves. But we were working on our projects while the contractors were working on theirs, and so we were just sort of it was just chaos. It was just 6 months. I don't remember any of it. It was just so busy every day. Evan learned how to build cupboard doors and polish stainless steel to do. He redid our whole kitchen himself. The doors weren't savable. They were just old
Like fiberboard.
fiberboard. Yeah. And so he took those and traced them onto new wood and reused the hardware and built some real nice new wooden doors for the kitchen cupboard.
Amazing. Wow. I'm very envious. I can't hammer a nail in. Okay. So six months of extreme hands-on work by you yourselves and also some contractors for some of the other stuff. Or you were saying maybe if you were doing most of it on your own, maybe about a year, right?
Maybe about a year, yeah.
And
Yeah,
that's
during that 6 months too, that's when we're doing all the getting the business incorporated. So we've got tons of paperwork and tons of meetings with the city and inspections, like the fire department coming out to inspect and things like that. And
Yes,
so
because we also got the licenses for the rental during that time. And we did everything to incorporate the business and open the bank accounts and all the requirements for the visas while we were living in an abandoned house while it was being renovated.
and that was it, I'm assuming. You didn't have any side jobs during that point in time, right?
No. We
Nice.
didn't do we weren't doing any farming. We weren't getting the honeybees started. Nothing like that until after the guest house was operational.
And you signed up for that. You knew that this is what it would involve when you first
Sort of.
kind of? Okay.
Yeah.
I thought we'd have time to do some prep on the fields, but yeah, we did not.
Yeah.
But
We went into it with the mindset that it was going to be a lot of work, and I think it was even more than we thought it would be. But we had sort of that mindset from the beginning that, this is going to be a lot of upfront work, and then as time goes on and things get established, then we'll be able to enjoy the Japanese countryside life.
and obviously you prepared financially as well. You had, I'm assuming, savings. You had money for the renovation project. Can you share? Is it okay to share a little bit about how much the total was?
Yeah, the total for the guest house, including purchase, renovation, licenses, and any furnishings that we didn't salvage from the house and toiletries, like, getting a guest house fully functional, including, shampoo and bedding and all of that, came to $39,000.
That's not bad at all. Wow. Okay. How old were the houses on purchase? When were they built?
This, well, the guest house was
63,
built.
63 for this one. No,
1953, the guest house was built, and it had been abandoned for 10 years.
And no structural issues at all.
Nope. Now, the son who grew up here, he's in his 70s now. He does still live in the neighborhood, so he may have been stopping in and checking things during that 10 years, but I don't really think so. Not a lot. It just, you know, it just got lucky that the roof held out. And
it's quite rare, I was going to say. We don't, I mean, again, you haven't done an official structural inspection, but obviously you'd know by now if something was crashing down. So
yeah,
that's a bit of luck there too, I think, for a property this old, right?
I think so.
Yeah. Well, nothing's parallel anymore, you know?
Yeah. It's not square.
Oh yeah, I wouldn't imagine it. Yeah. But I mean, again, no tilting, sinking, you're not actually noticing anything deteriorating, which is fantastic. Mm-hmm. Okay, and then I guess the next hurdle, maybe it wasn't a hurdle, I don't know, you tell me, how did the local community take to you?
Really well. You know, I didn't know what to expect. I don't know if you know this, but I had never been to Japan before arriving at the airport with our suitcases to move here. So I really didn't know what to expect and was putting a lot of trust into Evan, that I would like it, you know, and we'd done a lot of research. And boy, from the day we arrived, we just immediately felt welcomed. And I have heard from others online that may not always be the case.
Not always the case, no.
Yeah, it definitely was in our experience. And we've done a lot of thinking about why that might be. And maybe it's also because we weren't trying to go super remote. But, you know, we chose an area that's countryside, but there's constantly tourists coming through. So, you know, they're already accustomed to seeing Japanese and foreign tourists. Maybe that's part of it, or maybe they just were happy to have two less abandoned houses in the neighborhood.
Maybe you're just nice people and they like you. Did you maybe do the whole
they like really like Evan.
Giving gifts and stuff?
We brought omiyage from Mexico. Yeah, so we had chocolate and little Mexican crafts to give to people. But I think a lot of the older ladies really took to Evan, and I think that sort of got our foot in the door.
You do have a bit of a Musashi kind of vibe to you, Evan. Did you communicate with them a lot before actually opening doors on the guest house? Because that's
suddenly
turning a residential neighborhood into
because we were living here, first of all, you know, so we were here every day, and it's a small community. I think we thought it was 4,000, but
I think it's 6,500 on the island, but our neighborhood is only a small portion of that.
We're in a little village, and so we are surrounded by houses. It's not like we're just out in the middle of nowhere. Yeah. But so, I mean, you just can't help seeing the same people every day, right? And, you know, of course, so there's like a group of people that take their walks at the same time every evening. And
we were the talk of the town. We were doing something at the guest house every day. It was always something going on. So every evening when they took their walks, they would just stand at the front door and say, "What'd you guys do today?" You know, and talk amongst themselves and be like, "Oh, they're working on the garage now." Like, you know, everybody had an eye on what we're doing. And nobody, you know, in the US, people having a rental or a guest house, you know, is sometimes can have a bad name, and I don't think so here, because some of our neighbors will give us, you know, large amounts of oranges or things to give to the guests specifically, you know, and they ask us, you know, who's coming, or, you know, oh, I saw your guests cycle by. And so it does seem like a welcome addition to the neighborhood.
And we put a lot of money
Sorry,
we put a lot of money into the community before we started hiring the local craftsmen that we did, right? So just the contractor, all the contractors we used are on the island here. They're all local. And just the two doors down from us is the Tategu guy who did all the sliding doors and screens in our house. So, you know, that's been pretty good for word of mouth.
Now, if you've attended any of our recent JREP Summit events in Tokyo or online, you've probably heard our sponsor, Robert Miller from Innovatius.com. He's been in web solutions here in Japan for the past 25 years, and he's also an active investor in Japanese real estate property, as well as global online property, which is his specialty and what his company Innovatius is all about. They offer a full suite of website services for entrepreneurs and small business owners, including all aspects of web design and management, backup and updates, content formatting and editing, proactive maintenance and error fixing, you name it, with a strong focus on SEO excellence, which is what gets you those hardcore top-of-the-list search engine rankings. But there is a difference. Innovatius works off a simple, all-inclusive monthly subscription model, as opposed to the typical outdated and confusing project model. So you never have to wonder how much any request for any work to be done on your website might cost. It's always $497 per month. And if that's not enough, if you've mentioned you've heard of their services on the Japan Real Estate Podcast, you'll also get 10% off this monthly price for life. Also, and equally important, if not more, you can try out Innovatius for just 1 month, then switch them off, on again later if you want, and so forth. There are no minimum subscription terms. Now, if you're a small business owner, managing and growing a website is super distracting and time-consuming, right? That's exactly where Innovatius comes in. Robert's team takes care of all of that for you so that you can focus on what you do best. So feel free to email Rob on robert@innovatius.com, and his team will conduct a full SEO and website audit on your site, reveal anything that you should address to increase your website's appeal, and provide you with an easy-to-read detailed report with your own branding so that you can make some informed decisions on your online strategy and watch your business grow as you implement it. So once more, robert@innovatius.com. Drop him a line and get your website reviewed today.
Do you also participate in all of the local matsuri and cleaning events and all of the stuff that the local community does?
There haven't been very many, and one of our cleaning days got rained out. But yes, we're ready to participate when they happen. Yeah.
Gotcha. Do you feel some of it is due to the types of guests that you attract? I mean, obviously the location would dictate, you're not going to get like, you know, party people who are coming to Tokyo to rent the Airbnb, but do you target specific guest profiles?
Not really. And that is an interesting thing that I'm sort of trying to learn as we go. Because Airbnb, which is the platform that we used for the whole first year, is not super popular in Japan yet. So I think that's part of the reason that the majority of our guests have been from all over Europe, you know, North America, Mexico, all over the place. A small percentage of our guests have been Japanese, which is part of, I want to attract more Japanese guests because I think our guest house being specifically designed to be nostalgic for a certain Japanese era, you know, we really went with the Showa, retro. Every Japanese guest says it's like walking into their grandma's house. And that's exactly, like, that's the best compliment. I love it when they say that because that's exactly what we were going for. But most of our guests are foreigners. So that's interesting.
But you don't specifically target families or people of a certain age group, or
it's no, open list. Okay. Yep. Mm-hmm. We do get a lot of bicycle groups, and we would like to get more families because we thought we would, having a full kitchen and, you know, having it be a private house rental. So we'd be happy to get more families, but mostly couples and cycling groups.
Gotcha. Mm-hmm. All right. So, yeah, again, you're living the dream that a lot of people are constantly asking us about. But thank you for giving it a bit of a more aware kind of spin, so that people know what they're getting into. I guess, what are your plans aside from expanding the honey business and obviously hopefully getting more and more bookings? Any other plans? Any new business ventures? Any expansions? An extra guest house?
Well, we've got all kinds of plans. We like to do all kinds of things. But this winter and next spring, we are going to be doing some more renovations to the guest house. So, that will be in addition to, you know, the 39,000 total is going to go up a little bit because it's not a requirement to have a certain number of bathrooms per guests, but we want to increase to 10 guests. And I maybe it's an American mindset, but I feel like one toilet for 10 people is just like not enough. So we do have two rooms in the guest house that are they're currently blocked off, unrenovated, and we'd been planning from the beginning. As we got some more funding, then we can put that back into the guest house. So we're hoping to add a second bathroom, and then we have a few more things to do, like fix the bathtub. So we have a original 1953
Oh, the metal seasons kind of thing.
wood-fired bathtub. So, and it needs refinished. It's unusable. So right now the guest house is shower only, and a lot of people want that bath experience. So I know that for our whole first year, that's been sort of a drawback that we don't have a bathtub. So we're gonna learn how to re-enamel a bathtub this winter.
Wow,
So wish us
that's all
luck.
going to go on the YouTube channel, right? I'm hoping.
For better or worse, it will.
Fantastic. Well, where can I mean, obviously Benton Homestead is pretty unique. People can find you wherever they Google that, but are there any particular channels where they could go or should go to get, more of the interesting content?
Well, it's the most popular is Instagram and then our YouTube videos. I put the most effort into YouTube, but a lot of people do end up contacting me through Instagram, which is fine too. And then also on our website, I write longer blogs there and I post a lot more photography there. So I've got some photo blogs, and
And the shop is there too, right?
that's where our shop is. And that'll be expanded next year to include more antiques and vintage things.
No pickles?
Maybe.
We're actually we're looking for a commercial kitchen, and we're thinking we might there's some additional rooms in the guest house that are just like storage right now, and we're thinking about converting one of those into a commercial kitchen. And so I'm not sure about pickles, but we're targeting
Hot sauce.
hot sauce and salsa. And I just ordered some Hokkaido 8-row corn, which is an heirloom corn that I want to try and turn into masa for making tortillas and chips, possibly.
I'm very much looking forward to that. Awesome.
That was actually part of our plan for this year, but we weren't able to find a commercial kitchen to use. So in our we didn't intend to grow a whole field of peppers just to try and sell the fresh peppers. We were going to use all those peppers to make hot sauce. But the kitchen licensing here is a little different than we're used to in the US. And there's not, from what we understand, the concept of a share kitchen really doesn't exist here because of the whoever the kitchen is licensed to is responsible for anything made in their kitchen, even if it's not by them. So we approached a couple of restaurants who were excited about us using it on the days they were closed and renting from them. But then after they talked to the health department, they said they couldn't. So we are looking at either renting our own space or building our own space because we've got a whole field of peppers and that's only going to expand. And we're basically growing all the ingredients for hot sauce and salsa.
So to summarize everything we've just discussed in a single sentence, maybe from each of you, how are you feeling now after having made the move? So you've moved to rural Japan, you've set up your own business here, you've kind of made the dream come true. Pros, cons, total summary of the year to date.
Oh my goodness.
Is it everything you expected it to be? Is there anything that shocked you? Anything that was a pleasant surprise? Anything like that?
That's a really good question. For me, I really didn't As far as the community and living here, I didn't have any specific expectations going into it because I had never been to Japan. But despite how much work it's been and how tired I am very happy with our decision. And it's still going, there's still a lot of work ahead of us, but I think once we really get established, I don't think there's anywhere else we would rather be.
That's amazing. Evan, anything to add?
Yeah, I really miss New Orleans, and I think I know Danny does too, but I'm definitely happy here. And before I moved to New Orleans, I was planning on moving back to Japan. So so my story is different. I came here in high school, and I taught English after college. And as soon as I got back to the States after working as an English teacher, I just felt like I had made a terrible mistake. I wanted to get back to Japan immediately. And I tried and failed. And about 10 years later, almost 20 years later, you know, here I am. So I'm very happy here.
And you knew what you were getting into as well.
I did. Yeah, I had a better idea than Danny did, but
you hadn't lived in the countryside.
I hadn't lived in the countryside. It's been a lot more work than I thought it would be. Yeah. All said and done.
But similar, no regrets.
You know, we've made mistakes. That's part of what we're trying to do with the YouTube, is we're trying to help people from making the same mistakes that we did, and trying to, you know, right now what we're doing is crazy. I'll be honest, you know, like people say, like, aren't you, you know, don't you feel like you're crazy for doing this? And I mean, the answer is yes, it's a hard thing that we're doing. You know, we are pioneers, like we are, I don't know, pilgrims almost, but
high risk, high reward, I would say.
Yeah. So, I mean, I just think that, you know, what we have to be doing, we have to understand that, our responsibility here as pioneers is to make it easier for the next generation. And that's really what we're doing.
That's beautiful, beautiful to end on too. Thank you. Thank you very much for that. I appreciate you coming on.
Thank you so much for having us. Really nice meeting you.
Yeah, thank you very much.
So there you have it. Huge thank you to Danny and Evan. Aside from being a truly lovely couple, they're also living the dream that so many of you reach out to us to try and help make come true for you. Hopefully, after listening to this couple, you know a little bit more about what's actually involved in it and how to make it come true. That is, if after everything you've heard, you still do want to make this a reality. Now, before we go, we're also, as always, going to tell you and also link to our other sponsor's website. That's Hiroshi Shimizu, immigration lawyer and administrative scrivener. If you're thinking about moving here on a more permanent basis, or you're already in Japan on some sort of a temporary visa and you want to switch to a longer term or permanent one, or if you're considering setting up a local company or a branch office of a foreign company and you've got any sort of business or visa-related inquiries, or even if you just want to find out what your options are on any of these topics, feel free to contact Hiroshi Shimizu. You can find him at japanimmigrationexperts.com. And he can help you set up a company, apply for any kind of visa, or just provide you with the best advice and extremely affordable consultation related to these topics. And he's already done that for many of our listeners. So feel free to reach out to him. Again, that's japanimmigrationexperts.com, and you'll be well on your way. And that's it from us for today, folks. Hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Japan Real Estate Podcast. Do share it with your networks, and please let us know what you think. So leave us a short rating or review on the iTunes Store, on Spotify, or just drop us a line in the comment section of wherever you might have found this episode. We love hearing from you. Hope to have you with us again next time, and until then, have a great day or night ahead. Yoroshiku.